Duncan McLeod, and you're listening to the Tech Central podcast brought to you by BBD. I'm joined by BBD Director Gus Pringle for a conversation about the IT skills challenge in South Africa, and I think it's fair to call it a crisis, and what BBD is doing to try and mitigate it. Welcome to the podcast, Gus.
Thanks, Duncan.
So we chatted on the phone earlier this week, and you told me that no matter how many IT skills you develop and bring into the market, it's never enough for all the positions available. Given South Africa's extreme levels of unemployment, it's really concerning that the right skills simply aren't available. Before we talk about specifically about what BBD is doing in this respect, how do we begin to fix this as a country?
Duncan, so what the approach that we've followed has really been to try and look at alternatives to the historic sort of formal channels that we've always tried to rely upon. Those channels just really aren't cutting the sort of numbers and the types of skills that are required in the industry. There really is at this stage infinite demand. Whatever type of these types of skills that we can get a hold of, we immediately are able to place them into the market and generate value.
So from a broad country perspective, what are we doing wrong? How do we start to address this? I presume it all starts with education, right?
I think at the bottom end, we've got some big challenges, I think, at schools. I think there are certain schools that are able to excite these young kids and take them on the right track to effectively go into this industry, but I think the vast majority are poorly equipped in terms of infrastructure and definitely the skills. So we've seen a number of people going through into the formal education sector within universities, just not enough people heading out of that school system into the universities who do have the ability to create those skills.
Is it about throwing more money at the problem, or is it about doing things differently as a country?
Definitely doing things differently. I think we've had an incredible partnership with a crowd over the last 3 years. And if I can make mention of that name, it's We Think Code. A lady by the name of Arlene Mulder brought a program out of France called Ecole 42. And that program just creates a completely new channel, and yet still is able to achieve that 1% of 1% top-end skills that this industry requires.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk a bit about the We Think Code initiative. How did you guys get involved with that? How's it gone, and what are the results been like?
The results have been amazing. We got involved 3 years ago, so Arlene and her partner, Camille, pitched to us. They were looking for some founding sponsors. They'd come up with this really cool idea and this program, which was effectively free for students. It arose out of, as I said earlier, Ecole 42, which was a school that was founded in France, which was generating 1,000 developers a year out of their program. And she partnered with them and brought the program over this side. And it is... I think in the first year in 2017, they tested 40,000 kids. Mm-hmm. Of that 40,000 kids, I say kids loosely, but I think you've got to be under 35 to join the program. And they tested 40,000. They selected 400 for a one-month boot camp. And of that 400, they selected 110 to join the program. We, along with FNB and Derivco down in Durban, were the initial founding sponsors of that program. And we took on 28 students out of that first year. And those guys have competed head-on against our top university graduates who we brought in on that same year. I think we, out of the 28, we had one guy drop out. And so the results have been astounding.
That's amazing. And I think we should emphasize that We Think Code is not just taking on people who already have skills in coding and perhaps have studied it in some respect. Some of these guys are, you know, have no background in it, but they've just shown the aptitude to get involved in this industry and succeed.
Yeah, absolutely. So the super cool thing about the program is that it's an online test and then two sets of online tests which potentially get you onto the boot camp. And some of the stories, I mean, just two of them I'll share with you.
Sure.
The one guy was a security guard. He was working security and trying to support his wife and two young kids, and happened to stumble upon We Think Code, and he's now working for us, earning a junior developer salary, and doing really well, right up there with, as I said, the sort of university graduate guys, in terms of what he's delivering on an output basis. Another guy, I guess, which talks to the Fees Must Fall program, he was won a scholarship, not a scholarship, but a bursary through NSFAS to attend TUT. Was father lost his job. He was a petrol attendant, and he didn't have enough money to continue his studies. He was selling sweets on the pavement outside TUT. Eventually, just because of financial pressures, his results faltered, and he lost his bursary. He did We Think Code. Amazing story. I mean, he was invited to go to join Facebook in the US.
Wow.
And went. Went on a program over there. And he has a guy who would have been lost to the system. Hmm. Come on as an amazing young graduate, and now junior. Not a graduate, now a software engineer for BBD. Yeah. Hmm.
Do you think that we need more initiatives like this, or do you think We Think Code can be expanded to take on more people?
I think, you know, there are different streams. So one of the challenges in our industry is that we really do operate in an extremely complex, in the bespoke software development side of things. We operate at a really technically complex, very top end of the value chain. Mm. And so, you know, we find that we're having to drive quality on a massive basis. But, you know, one of the anecdotal sort of pieces of evidence around software engineers is that for every single software engineer that you create 10 ancillary jobs around him. And so, you know, We Think Code, I think in the last 3 years now, we're probably numbering close to 75, 80 students that we'll have brought into the company, and that multiplies by 10. The other people in the software development life cycle, testers, business analysts, all sorts of people who could benefit from similar type programs. Mm. I think We Think Code has been a differentiator in terms of that it's been able to identify that talent and then grow it.
So, Gus, we know about the serious skill shortage in the sector, but where is the demand for skills coming from, and what type of skills are being sought? And are we seeing a skills mismatch in terms of what is available and what employers are looking for?
So the clients that we work for, Duncan, are generally the types of operations. We've got a very simple way of putting it, in that their IT and their technology that they invest in is a strategic differentiator for them. So we're talking about the big banks. We're talking about certain departments in the government space. We're talking about telecommunications. And those guys, if they're not continuously investing in moving their technology into the latest and greatest space, then some competitor is going to eat their lunch. And so the types of people that they're looking for are people who can deliver on those solutions. And with the massive growth in the technology sort of requirement, I mean, you think about you and I, we didn't know what a phone was that could we could buy everything on, that we could interact with. 10 years ago, it wasn't there. Or maybe, you know, 10 years ago, probably not probably fair enough to say that a little bit further back. And so to allow those channels to be used by those companies, they're looking for the top-end skills to create that those chains of value and be able to transact very quickly. And the types of guys we use are those people who can deliver on that.
So I suppose a challenge for big corporates is that not only do they need to develop systems and solutions for this new era, let's call it the smartphone era or the online era, where consumers expect everything instantaneously, and you know there's a range of new solutions that have to be developed, but they also have legacy systems that they have to maintain and develop, and often it's those legacy systems on top of which these newfangled solutions are being developed. Are the corporates getting the skills they need to be able to maintain that legacy infrastructure as well?
So, I mean, it's cri- critical part of what we do as a business, is to the nirvana that, that many big operations would hope to achieve is to have a single technology and a single solution that spans across all their businesses. We see many operations that are refreshing their technology systems, and yet for some particular reason just cannot move off the legacies. And so we literally can have two or three solutions providing the same service, but they just cannot remove certain clients or certain parties off those legacy systems. And that becomes a huge part of the complexity in what the types of guys that that we bring into the business and that have to be trained. They need to understand how to integrate with those legacy systems, how to plumb them in into the new thing and the new immediate sort of requirement that you and I have. And so we have a number of clients where they've got these monolithic old systems that that need to be they need systems on top of them that can operate really quickly, and that's where the really sexy tech comes in actually plumbing that. In terms of maintaining those old systems, COBOL developers, they're still guys running around the banks, and I don't think they're disappearing anytime soon. It's a difficult part of the requirement in that the young guys don't obviously want to go and do COBOL.
I was about to say,
not a chance in hell. And so there's definitely a shortage of skills in that space, and effectively the clients get into dangerous technical debt if they don't look at continually improving and refreshing those systems. And many clients are in that space.
How do you get the youngsters obviously don't want to learn COBOL or this is real legacy technology, but there's still a real demand for it. Someone has to do it. So how do you convince youngsters perhaps to look at it?
No, you don't.
You don't.
You don't. No, I think I would say 90% of COBOL developers and guys doing those legacy systems are going a bit grey in the hair. Yeah, it is a space which is becoming increasingly dangerous for the big corporates to ensure that they can maintain. And so obviously a lot of them are investing hugely in making sure that they take that risk
away. Get off those systems eventually.
Absolutely.
But it's not easy, as you say.
I mean, no, not
so,
easy.
Like, so much legacy, so much complexity built into these systems over decades.
Huge.
That just forklifting out is impossible.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
So you guys supply very high-end skills into industry, working on bespoke, complex systems. I imagine these skills are obviously in very high demand, and they're very easily able to job hop for higher pay. Or, and I know you mentioned this to me when we chatted on the phone, emigrate, which you say has become a huge problem in the last year. How do you deal with this?
Duncan, it's accelerated in the last 6 months, interestingly, and I think I think everybody's sitting on the edge of their seat waiting as to what's going to happen with this election. I think it will probably inform as to whether that acceleration continues at the same level that it has over the last 6 months, or hopefully declines. So one has to obviously try and pay people correctly, but I think people are looking for far more in their future, and they are incredibly mobile. These guys who work for us have the ability to have a job signed, sealed, ready to go far in advance of them actually moving over to be at New Zealand, the ones we're seeing at the moment, New Zealand, Australia, and Netherlands. And so as a business, we've got to effectively try and retain those skills. And what we've had to do is look at opening businesses in those locations. Some of our competitors have already done so, and it's a massive loss of skills to this country. But I think as a business, we've also got to expand geographically. And if we can take the people we know and trust with us on that journey and retain them, that's absolutely what we've got to do.
Yeah, I was going to ask whether IT, it's all connected, the internet. Can you realistically continue to use these guys' skills even though they happen to be living in another city, in another country?
So the economic conditions in the country inform that largely. I think if we are in a growth phase and, you know, the ability of our clients to pay for those skills earning dollars and euros is a possible, then absolutely they can work back this way. But the fact of the matter is that a software engineer working for euros and dollars is pretty much out of the market to provide services back into this country. And so we have an office in India. Pricing-wise, there's similar pressure on skills, but salaries in Indian locations are slightly lower. And so we're able to use those skills in the SA market. But to use a guy based in Netherlands or Australia back in South Africa, unrealistic terms of value.
Yeah. It depends on the type of work that's being done as well. Not all projects can be done remotely. It might be you're working on a particular part of a project that requires some coding that you can deliver. But if you're involved in a complex process here in South Africa, like building a bank, for example, I suppose you need to be on the ground talking to your colleagues, interfacing.
Absolutely. I think particularly on a pressurized project, and we're dealing with a couple of those, the client likes to be able to sort of touch and feel you and make sure that you're there when, you know, there's pressures around deadlines and deliverables. First prize is to be pretty damn close to the client. And so we do have models which we've worked with where we've got guys on the ground here backed up by offshore locations from Bulgaria, actually, and India. But really, when the pressurized project comes together, it's first prize to have a small team working pretty closely together and able to talk to each other about what's going on, and for the client to give immediate and real feedback. Yeah.
So we're leaving people to foreign climes, but can we make it easier for foreigners to come and work in South Africa? Is the immigration regime favorable to doing this, or does it need an overhaul?
It's been challenging. So we have tried to bring people into the country just on critical skills type visas. And so, for instance, so we can grow our own juniors, and we've had a good success in that space. But you also have a shortage of senior and intermediate software engineers. And those guys, the industry is built around teaching. So if you don't have senior guys in your space to put into a project, you can't put juniors in. And so there's a shortage of seniors. So what we looked to do was to try and bring some of our senior guys in from our Indian office, you know, on be it a 6 month or a year or two year process. And incredibly difficult, months and months and months of process and trying different avenues to try and get them into the country for those types of periods, very difficult.
Incredibly frustrating.
It is, because you turn around, we're turning clients away. And so there's infinite demand. And those guys, you know, they don't take away from the industry. They're not taking anybody else's job. They really are, it's a required new skill that will teach new skills in the country.
Yeah.
It's massively value-adding to the economy to have a software engineer arrive in this country. And so to not enable that is just absolute madness.
Madness, it sounds. I mean, madness. we're losing these critical skills, and yet we make it difficult to
be able to come replace them. Exactly.
So let's talk a bit about the school system and the universities. Let's start with schools. Are schools equipping youngsters for careers in IT, or do you find that, generally speaking, once they matriculate, they need to be reskilled?
Duncan, so our sort of experience in this space is that there are some historically advantaged schools which have got relatively good programs. Some of the guys are teaching some of the latest tech. There's still many schools which are teaching some old tech, and the programs are not what they should be. The best guys that we see coming out of school are self-taught. Mm-hmm. And so, fortunately, we've got YouTube, we've got Google, we've got Pluralsight, and a whole bunch of a lot of them are free coding platforms where guys can and girls can learn to code. and grow their skills significantly. So, I mean, for instance, we had a guy come out of out of school, and he interviewed here for a bursary. And interestingly enough, he was already doing work for a Swiss company. And he had a bit of a chuckle because he told us the story about the guy putting really big pressure on him just before his matric exams to get some piece of functionality delivered. And he was trying to avoid having the conversation that he was writing his matric exam. because then the guy would understand how young he was. Mm-hmm. And so, if you're good, you're good. You can get guys who started coding when they, 10, 11 years old. And they're delivering solutions out there to clients who will pay for them on the open market. Mm.
It's kids who are really interested in this stuff to start with, right, that eventually make those careers. I mean, all the kids that I went to school with who today work as programmers or work in the IT field were doing it when they were in high school.
100%. But it's not a career. It's
their
fun.
Passion.
It's fun. Mm. And for us, that's the differentiator. Mm. So the guy who gets great marks, he's probably got a good potential of being a software engineer, software developer. But they got a particular way of thinking. So it's almost like, nobody really gets hooked on Sudoku without being given a book of Sudoku puzzles. And if you get given a book of Sudoku puzzles for the rest of your life, it's not work, it's play. And software engineers are a bit like that, really. Mm-hmm. They've had a teacher who've opened that book for them at school. Yep. And given them the tools to maybe, move to the second or third page or move to intermediate and advanced. And if you don't have that teacher and that environment, then you're losing a huge number of people. And we don't, for the most part, have that teacher or that environment in place for the kids.
Speaking in very broad terms, and let's say a high school principal is listening to this podcast, what advice would you give to them? What should they be doing to encourage children to take up IT as a career, or to help those who are already interested to move in that direction?
I think for me, we've got a responsibility in the space within the industry. I think we've got to get some of our young guys to take some clever stuff to the schools and show people what is out there. It really is just putting that hook in and exposing them to a very small piece of interesting stuff, because the rest of it is just the ability to go online and learn further. Mm. You need that initial hook that gets people understanding that, the stuff you see on your phone, there's people who've played and worked to get that stuff together. It's not a big product company or a Microsoft who necessarily puts that stuff together. It could be a little company of two or three guys who've put something really clever together and developed it. And any person with the gift, and there are many people with that gift have the ability to do that, and to show them that it's not as hard as they might think.
So in many respects, it's actually perhaps just about sparking that curiosity.
I think it is, yeah. Mm. So we've started some sort of discussions around trying to reach out to certain schools and have some of our sort of research and development guys, our training guys, go into those schools and show people some cool stuff about how easy it is potentially to play with tech. Mm. Because if you get them playing, the learning is not an issue. They literally learn through play.
How are the university computer science departments doing? Are they producing the skills that are needed? Are they focusing on the right areas?
Duncan, I think when we started with We Think Code, it came out of a frustration with the number of people that were coming out of universities and the quality thereof. So if I talk to our experience, we had a couple of universities that really do have great programs, and those programs are generally built around a couple of very competent professors and lecturers. They have that particular skill to excite people and drive their willingness and their sort of passion to learn. But we're just not getting enough, and I think some of the diplomas that we're seeing issued for technology degrees are are challenging in terms of the skills that are coming out. We tried for a long time to bring those people into the business and try and train them, give them additional training. But for the most part, it really was a failure. There are some great universities. There are some great programs, but far too few. So I would say we probably concentrate on 4 or 5 universities in the country, and those universities generally have a particular individual or 2 or 3 individuals if they're lucky, as I said earlier, from a professorship and a lecturer perspective who can drive the program. And we send our R&D guys and our training guys into those universities to try and enrich those programs and give those lecturers some sort of feedback on what we think they should be teaching and how they should be teaching it. And guys welcome us with open arms. They enjoy that interaction with the industry because it's important that they're not getting left behind the curve. And this curve is pretty steep.
Yes.
It's changing incredibly fast. In the last 3 years, we've seen frameworks come and go. And what was yesterday's flavor of the month is gone tomorrow. It really is.
So these university courses are going to have to be changed on a very regular basis. It's not like studying accountancy where the rules do change, but incrementally and very slowly. In computer science, you almost need to revise the curriculum every year.
No, Duncan, you know, I think I'm not an engineer, so I've got to be very cautious to comment in this space. But you know, the universities have to teach fundamentals of software engineering, and that they get right. But those courses need to be continually enriched, and that's where I think that interaction is important. But a lot of the stuff is available on online programs, and so that is available out there to those programs, and they have the ability to make sure that those form part of the curriculum, and I think they do. The good guys do.
So what advice would you give to someone, a youngster, who's looking at getting into this industry for the first time, perhaps looking to become a developer? What advice would you give them in terms of what they should be doing to develop the skills they need? I mean, is it all about, they could obviously go to university, they could go through a program like We Think Code, but from what you've been telling me, it almost seems that the most important thing is that they have the ability and the interest to self-learn and to use the internet to further themselves.
Yeah, I think there's some great starter programs out there. One comes to mind immediately called freecodecamp.org. And start playing. Start literally trying, start the journey of opening the book and trying to challenge yourself to do something in that space. The formal education aspects of it can come later, but as I said earlier in the discussion, the really good guys we see have been playing with tech for 3-4 years by the time they're in matric. We see a lot of guys coming through who start in grade 10 as part of a formal education, it's great. But it doesn't necessarily excite them. I think the online stuff really has the ability to excite, obviously underpinned by the fundamentals that they learn through a formal system or a slightly less formal system like a Week Think Code or similar.
Do you ever find older people who perhaps weren't even in the industry or were peripherally related to the industry decide to have a mid-career change and become developers? Does that ever happen?
I tried. I failed. So, interestingly enough, we just find the energy and the I think the interaction that the younger generation have around a square screen, they are generally far faster than sort of midlife crisis people. We have had people trying to make changes, but I think the ability to play, maybe as we get older, we lose that a bit. And hence, if we lose the ability to play, we lose the ability to learn in this particular space. And I'd hate to make that a rule, but it is.
That's,
I think, we've seen a couple of examples of it, and they haven't been wildly successful.
And what about youngsters people who start in this industry in their teens? Do you find that by the time they're in their 40s or 50s, they are starting to lose that ability to learn new things?
So it's part and parcel of this industry. So if you're not continually learning, you're getting left behind. As a business, it's a key part of what we try and push into our people, is that if you're not taking control of your own future, you have the potential to be moving yourself into technical debt. And you know, there's some solid foundational technologies which are not going away anytime soon. But yeah, the young guys are coming through and putting the older guys under pressure. But you know, the older guys also move into slightly different aspects. Instead of hardcore coding, they'll be looking at not necessarily consulting, but you know, they'll be leading teams. They'll be doing the more difficult architecture aspects of putting these solutions together, having had experience on how to make a system deal with 1,000 business transactions a second. You know, a young guy is not necessarily going to build for that sort of scalability, whereas some of the older guys have seen it and been around the track once or twice to understand how to do that, and so they have an ability to move into other places in the industry,
become leaders in core teams and that sort
absolutely
of thing.
Yeah, or move into our clients and, you know, create a closer marriage between business and technology, because they understand, they've actually grown up in the trenches as such.
Do, as a matter of interest, do developers eventually typically end up moving into management roles? Are they, do they have the mindset for it? Your typical CIO, does he come from a technical background like that, or does he come from with a, you know, MBA and management sort of background?
Duncan, so we see two streams generally. So we see guys who and girls, please, I need to, and we don't have enough girls, so that is another important aspect. So we generally see two streams. We see a technical stream, we see a business stream. So what we have is guys who move into they slowly start taking more and more of a business slant. They potentially enjoy managing people, they enjoy interacting face-to-face with a client, and so they bring a huge amount of technical experience into that space in order to be realistic around the solutions that can be delivered into business spaces. Ideally, I think most of the CIOs that we interact with, first prize is if they've got some good fundamental sort of engineering knowledge, ideally in software engineering. I think a lot of the guys have also got quite good process sort of experience, and that also becomes an important aspect of you know, some of the base skills that they bring to those roles. But I'm no expert. I think in terms of the other stream, in terms of guys who go massively technical, we've got guys here who still are playing at you know, well into their sort of late 50s, and they remain an incredibly important part and valued part of the value chain within a business like ours. But they don't want to interact with people, and they don't want to manage anybody, and they don't want to be put under pressure to go and, you know, reach certain profitabilities or anything. They want to dive deeply into the tech and create massively elegant solutions in very complex spaces.
Managing IT development staff, is it different to managing other types of employees? Are they difficult?
180 degrees. Yeah. No, they do.
How do you keep them happy?
It's a great bunch of people. Yeah. I think so one of the things in this business is we try and have as few rules as possible. The second you have a rule, you lose the individual, because you're going to try and apply a broad policy across massively different people. And I think it's, for us, you know, the basics around paying right and making sure that you recognize, you give recognition where it's due. But I think generally the guys just want to continually be learning.
Yes.
The really good guys, so they want to be exposed to new technology. They want to be exposed to new challenges. They want to be exposed to guys who can have got something to teach them. And so the cycling in and out of teams and through teams and up teams into different tech and situations and types of businesses becomes an incredibly important part of the growth journey. And sometimes we get it right, hopefully more often than not, but we stuff it up fairly regularly as well.
But lots and lots of conversations, I'd imagine.
Lots and lots of conversations, absolutely. Mm. Yeah, and hopefully, you know, with people, a lot of the guys, I think, in the industry, in our space, struggle with those conversations. A lot of the guys are fairly quiet,
introverted.
Not as a rule, but yeah, there are. There's probably more in our industry than average, and so you've got to be very careful in how you interact with those people.
Yeah.
And make sure that they are heard, even though they've got very small voices.
Mm. Interesting. Before we wrap up, and you did mention it briefly a moment ago, let's talk about the fair agenda.
Sure.
We know that the IT industry has historically been very male-dominated. I take it that is still the case. How concerned should we be that more women aren't taking up IT as a career?
I think very concerned. We've seen the a lot of the young women who've come into the industry. We've been incredibly impressed with. I think attention to detail and work ethic are two things where I think not and I'll be cautious of generalizing, but they definitely operate at a very high level. And I'm not quite sure where we're losing them. I think it's at school level.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's in terms of, you know, what is potentially even a parenting level, you know, seeing your daughter play video games, which is where a huge number of these people start. Watching your daughter play video games is quite unusual, and yet we should be moving in that direction, is trying to actually have them interact with tech as early as possible in whatever form, so the interest is sparked.
It's weird that it's so male dominated, because if you look back to certainly the US back in the 1950s and 60s, it was a team of women developers who put man on the moon. It was a female dominated industry back then, and something changed in between, and now it's a male dominated industry. I don't know what happened. Why there were so many women working in programming back then, and why there are so few today?
Yeah, I don't know. Perhaps in terms of the types of skills that feed into our space, you don't necessarily have to be fantastic at maths. That's a good indicator that you probably have an aptitude. And I do think that women probably at school level, I mean, my experience, generally the girls in the class were damn sight brighter than a lot of the men. And yet they fell into other careers. Attention to detail. But I think it comes back to the play aspect. You know, is it cool for a girl to be playing a video game, you know, first shooter?
So it's a cultural, societal thing.
I think it could be, yeah. And so, you know, to the extent that we can try and open up channels where girls can play with tech as early as possible and be interested in it, anything we could do in that space would be great.
Mm.
I can't think offhand that we're doing anything in that space right now to drive it. And the cultural norms and societal norms are sending girls into other spaces.
Do you think they're put off as well by knowing that they'd be working in a male-dominated industry?
Possibly. I think, you know, we do need some people up there too who are people can aspire to be, some leaders in the space. And I think there are not many stories.
Mm.
They really aren't. I can't think of any top end people in the technology space who are driving that agenda, who could be aspirational to young women or fan.
Gus, I think we'll wrap it there. This has been a fascinating discussion, although somewhat depressing at times, especially when we're talking about immigration. And hopefully after the election, that situation is reversed. But thanks so much for your time, and thanks for talking to Tech Central on this podcast.
No, thanks, Duncan. I actually think it's not necessarily depressing, because I think we're seeing a whole new group of people enter the industry. And although we've got challenges, I really do think for a whole bunch of people who historically have not had opportunity to enter the industry, we're seeing some channels that are allowing those people to come in. So I disagree with you. I think the positive, there are a huge number of positives coming out of it.
Well, thank you for ending it on a positive note. Thanks, guys.
Cool. Thanks.